Welcome to the Lights Out Podcast. This is Chris Lights Out Lytle, and this is our journey to document the history of mixed martial arts. I've brought with me my friend, the MMA detective Mike Davis, and together we will preserve the history and hear some great stories from the world in the era of the no holds barred. Thank you and enjoy. All right, what's happening, everybody? Thank you for listening. As usual, man, what a special treat we got here. Damn, I'm excited. If you guys can see right now, it's not Mike Davis. I'm excited, but well, I like Mike. You know, great guy. But I mean, we got Dan Henderson here. You're not gonna get a bigger name in this sport than this. Damn, how the hell are you doing, Dan? And thank you for being here.
I'm doing great, and thanks for having me. I'm feeling good these days. Just getting a little older, grayer at least.
Man, so, I mean, you started this sport, I mean, before me, so, and you were already just, I mean, the things you'd put your body through before that just with wrestling, unbelievably tough. How are you feeling physically, man? I mean, please tell me it gets better at some point. It doesn't just keep getting harder.
You know, my body's not feeling too bad. Even nice. When I retired, it wasn't feeling bad. I was just not recovering well. I just was a little tired during training camp, a lot more than usual, and laying on the couch too much instead of hanging out with the kids or whatever. So I figured it was about time when I was 46.
Yeah, that's old. I think I have, I mean, I came out of retirement a little bit, had a couple bare knuckle fights at 44, but bare knuckle was so much easier because I didn't have to do all the wrestling, the jiu-jitsu, just so like a stand up. That was the easiest part, but I mean, it's still, trying to get through the camp is a hard part. Being able to do that at 46 is unbelievable. So that's really impressive.
Yeah, I just watched the last bare knuckle with Chad Mendez. Ooh. It was a good show. But, yeah, I mean, that would have been fun to do.
I mean, yeah, that's what happened to me. I was retired and I saw it. I was like, I got to do a couple fights. I mean, it was – I wish you would have been around 15 years ago. I would have loved it. You would have been probably the undefeated champ with that.
The boxing aspect is one thing, but being able to dirty box is another.
Well, if you look, our boxers haven't fared very well. I mean, we just had that Mike Alvarado on there, and he came in with his hands like this, and he got wrecked. You know, it's like, this isn't boxing with no gloves. It's different. You know, this is a cross between MMA and boxing, and the MMA guys have really done very well in here. You would have killed it.
Yeah, it looks fun.
Yeah. Oh, it's my favorite thing to watch right now. So entertaining at all times.
Let's get some plugs out of the way. Dan, you obviously came here, you know, for a reason. Let's talk about what you got going on.
You know, I have a gym that it's in Southern California, and about every 3 months I do an amateur show, Hendo's Fight Night. So, those are always entertaining also, probably not quite as entertaining as a bare knuckles, but
good.
It's fun. It's a good experience for all the little amateur guys that are local and you know, in the Southern California area. And then I just finished a book that's coming out in October. So
nice.
It should be, it's a pretty good one. Actually, I was surprised at how well it turned out.
What's the name of that book?
Yeah.
You know, the name is, it's a little bit different. It's called Hendo, the American Athlete. But when I was fighting in Pride in Japan for 3 years, the Japanese media kind of nicknamed me the American Athlete. So, I mean, it wasn't over here in the States, but it was just over there where they called me that. And I thought it might have been a good name for the book.
I like it. Oh, no. Another quick question. Where exactly are those fights you put on in Southern California? I mean, L.A. or?
No, they're in – I live in Temecula, and they're actually inside my gym in Temecula. So we usually pack about 500 or 600 people in there.
Beautiful.
That's a pretty good night.
That's a huge gym. So,
yeah,
Dan
– huge gym size.
That is
great. All right. So one of the questions that I've always kind of wanted an answer to is November 22nd, 1996, Reality Super Fighting. It's an 8-man tournament. You got Tom Erickson that meets Murillo Bustamante in the finals. Henzo warned Rico Ciparelli several times not to corner that night, and Rico got thrown out of Henzo's gym. and then he starts Raw. Is that, am I right on like how that laid out?
You know, that sounds familiar, like it's about right. Yeah. I don't know exactly. I know that it was because he was coaching and supposedly giving away the secrets of whatever secrets those were of jiu-jitsu, of the greats of jiu-jitsu.
All right. So Ciparelli and Hickson also grapple. People always talk about Schultz, Mark Schultz and Hickson, but no one ever talks about Ciparelli and Hickson. Were you present at that match?
No.
Oh, fuck. I heard Hickson couldn't take him down and they had to start in certain positions. I got to get a hold of Rico. All right. So you start with the Victorville Jets with your father's wrestling program. And you work your way through the Olympics, national champion. But your first fight, like your first submission grappling match, was October 11th, 1997, the Contenders with Frank Shamrock. How much jiu-jitsu had you done prior to going up against Frank?
Hardly any. And I was just coming back from the Greco World Championships, and I had screwed my ankle up really bad while I was over there. So it was swollen and purple still. And I wore wrestling shoes also. So it just wasn't the obviously I didn't know any better, but it wasn't set up very nicely for me to do any type of submission stuff or get out of any ankle locks for one. But yeah, it was a learning experience for sure.
Okay. So Randy, okay, UFC 17's headline is Mark Coleman versus Pete Williams. It becomes a UFC Hall of Fame fight, but the original opponent was Randy Couture. Randy Couture and Coleman were supposed to headline.
Ooh. I don't think that's true. That was 17.
Let me tell you the rumor.
I mean, that might be true. Did Randy hurt his ribs? Is that the one where Randy's ribs were hurt?
That's it. Did you hurt his ribs?
That was in a Greco practice because we were training both wrestling still and MMA at that point. So yeah, I mean that's probably what happened. Yeah,
you hurt his ribs. Okay.
So Dan, real quick, at this time, are you guys competing in MMA just because you think it to make a little bit of money? Did you think it was ever going to be anything big? What was in your head? Were like, this is kind of fun, or you didn't care about it as much as wrestling? What were you thinking when you fought?
It was just a way to make some money to keep wrestling for me. You know, my first fights, I mean, I had about 2 weeks of crash course of grappling and MMA you know, but the sport wasn't what it is now. I couldn't do that now and expect to do any good at all. But you know, my first fight was against a Gracie black belt. So, I mean, I did okay, but looking back at that fight, I mean, I rolled around like a little junior high wrestler that, you know, I was in so many bad positions, but it was just such a sloppy match. So I'm surprised I didn't get caught in anything.
Chris, let me set this up. This is really good because something happened backstage. So it's in Brazil. It's June 15th, 1998. You weighed in at 176 pounds, which I think is your career lightest. And Crescio de Souza is your opponent. You got Carlson Gracie, Waleed Ishmael in his corner. Did Waleed beat up the referee backstage because he thought it was an early stoppage?
You know, I wouldn't be surprised. I'm not sure. I know that they a lot of people rushed the cage trying to get in. Luckily, the cage walls were like 10 feet tall, you know, and then my legs started cramping. So I sat down in the cage and I had no idea what they were saying over the intercom. But, you know, that I know that Crazio came out and said, hey, we need to respect the referee, and he stopped it, blah, blah, blah. They were going to restart it, and he said, no, we need to respect the referee. But they did change the referee and put him in the back. And I think they brought out what's his face from Brazil that refereed for a long time?
Frederico Lupenda or Sergio Bottarelli? Which one? Sergio Bottarelli.
Neither one of them. Another guy that he's reffed in the UFC a bunch back in the day.
Yamasaki.
Yeah.
Boom. Yeah.
Now when that was going on, were you ever thinking, man, this shit might get out of control? They might try and legitimately kill us. Or was there anything? Were you nervous like that or not really?
Oh yeah, no, I was kind of nervous. The prior to that, I had heard stories about a MMA fight between like Lucha Libre and like the shootbox guys or whatever, and somebody stabbing somebody through the cage. I don't need to get next to the cage, but it was a little bit scary. I wasn't sure if they were wanting to get me or the ref. You know, I didn't stop the fight. So. But yeah, it was an early stoppage though. Regardless, I mean, I don't think he would have went anywhere, and I might have finished him pretty good. But it was right when they were trying to clean up the sport, so that they had told the referee if there was 5 unanswered shots to the face in a row, stop the fight. But I mean, I threw more than 5 punches, but a lot of them didn't really hit him very well or at all. So it was a little bit early, and maybe I would have landed a couple good ones after that. I don't know. But yeah, it was what it was, but yeah, I was pretty nervous about it. My first fight ever.
Yeah, so the rumor was Waleed really tuned the referee up backstage. Like the authorities had to get involved.
Yeah, I remember being out at some place, a bar or something with all those guys in either later that night or the next night. And I think he was trying to start shit with me. But not in a real bad way. But I mean, if I was a different type of attitude or personality, I'm sure it would have started. But I stay away from shit like that.
Go ahead, Chris.
Real quick, besides that, how did they treat you in Brazil afterwards? I mean, I thought whenever, I mean, usually they treat people really well. I feel like they would look up to you afterwards. Were they cool to you afterwards? I mean, like all the fans, all the people, were they like, that's the guy who beat our guy? Were they pretty good with you?
No, they were pretty good. I think overall it was a good trip. That was my first time down there. So yeah. I didn't know what to expect, but that was, they treated me well.
Yeah. And Chris, the thing is, it was a 4-man tournament. First fight, Brazil, 4-man tournament. His second opponent is Eric Smith, Hammerhouse guy. Eric beats Pele Landis. This is right around the time Pele.
I remember this.
Pat Miletich. When Pat Miletich is wearing a belt. And Dan beats a jiu-jitsu black belt, in D'Souza, in DiPresio, and taps out Eric Smith with a guillotine, like unconscious within under a minute.
Doesn't he quit then never fight again?
He never fought again.
Man.
He beats like one of the top 5 guys in the entire world, loses to a top 5 guy in the entire world.
Yeah, that was the sport back then. Nobody was that well rounded, so he couldn't handle the wrestling, and all Eric did was take him down and try to ground and pound and headbutt him. Headbutts were legal. So it was interesting.
So, Dan, you mentioned you shy away from street fighting, correct?
Yes. And I know where you're going with that one.
So, in Atlanta, in 1995, Aaron Cressy, yourself, Heath Sims, and Randy Couture had an issue with some of the bouncers at a bar.
That could be true.
So Randy was down there to meet with the Olympic Committee. He's going to become the face of the organization. And
he was on the board.
On the board.
And it was a board meeting. And they went out and he wasn't drinking that night because he was hungover. But they took him to the same bar that we beat up the bouncers at, yeah. And he didn't know. We didn't know. We were walking by a bar, and they Randy bumped into a parked car, and they came out trying to start shit. The manager was a little manager, a guy with a stick, trying to talk shit. And you know, it was they didn't have a good attitude to be bouncers, so we kind of fixed that for them.
I like it.
Yeah, Randy goes to dinner there the following evening, where they inform the entire table that Randy has to leave.
Yeah, I wasn't there, so I heard all about it, though.
Good. Anyway, moving on, Tito Ortiz. You and Tito never fought, but at the backstage of King of the Cage, February 24, 2004, Tito, from what I understand, was giving you the finger and kind of trying to start stuff with you. Is that true?
I do not think so. If he did, I wasn't aware. I don't think he's ever done that. But not to me, anyway. I'm sure he's done. I know I've seen him do it to other people. But.
I was thinking, like, when I heard that rumor, I was thinking, that might not be the right one to do it to. So
yeah,
I think he's smarter than that.
Yeah. So early on here, who are you training with? Are you training with Randy and everything? I mean, Team Quest hasn't started yet, but I mean, is that who you're working out with at the time?
Yeah, Randy and I were training partners in wrestling. And then, you know, decided to try MMA. And then we started training together doing both, you know, so... Then obviously, you know, getting other guys that, you know, boxing coaches, kickboxing coaches that, you know, just to work on other stuff. Because there was no MMA coaches in anywhere back then. So,
I mean, Team Quest turned out to be like one of the best gyms ever. When did that kind of start falling together? Like with who else started coming? I know it's you two, but then who else really started making that a reality?
Randy and I, when I was living up there training, I moved up there for like the last year before the 2000 Olympics and or a year and a half probably and trained full time with them up there. And during that time, there was some friends of ours had a health club, a building that had a health club in it, and they weren't paying their rent. So they got evicted and they asked us if we wanted to take it over. It wouldn't cost us anything, just paying rent. And we kind of just took it over and then started, and we called it Performance Quest. And then we started fighting out of there and called it Team Quest.
Nice.
What about Raw?
What's that?
What about Raw with Rico Ciparelli, Matt Yunchenko, Frank Trigg, yourself, Couture?
That didn't end well with Rico and Lou. You know, they just kind of were a little bit on the shady side and then let me out of my contract. And then I went and fought in Japan and won that rings tournament and then sent me a bill trying to get paid.
Ooh.
And then I had to go to court with them for a while and then they ended up losing. So it was, I just lost all respect for those guys.
Yeah, no, it happens. Matt Yunchenko, what was it like working out with him?
I didn't work out with him a whole lot, maybe once. But yeah, he was a big, tough Russian dude for sure. And I've worked out with tons of Russians for wrestling, but not in MMA. And I don't think we sparred. I think we mostly just grappled. But yeah, he was more up in LA, and I didn't get up there a whole lot. I worked out with Trigg a bunch more than him. And obviously Randy. That was mostly it back then. Among other guys, I think Eric Paulson, you know, was working out with us back then too.
Man, Paulson.
After he got dragged around the cage with his ponytail.
Oh. That was brutal. That was a brutal, brutal fight to watch. UFC 151, John Jones is supposed to fight yourself. And
they didn't have a 151.
They did have a 151. Would you mind? Go ahead.
No, you know, I was excited for that fight and probably the most ready I'd ever been. And I was in super good shape, like even 6-8 weeks out. And probably 3 weeks out, I tweaked my knee, my MCL popped, and, you know, all the athletic trainers and physical therapists that I had said, you know, rarely need surgery for that ligament, but, you know, it's just stretched out and it'll heal on its own and it might be okay in a couple, 2-3 weeks. But no, it was, I kind of took it easy and just did cardio for a couple of weeks and tested it out. And, you know, it just, if it was up to me, I probably would have still went, but my team just said no. I mean, that's the only fight I've ever pulled out of in 20 years, John Jones fight. So I was pretty bummed. And then they didn't give me the opportunity again after that.
So Chael Sonnen was going to replace you. And the rumor was that Chael had been training all along. I mean, you know how the internet goes. And was sliding in to fight John Jones, and John didn't like the matchup, and it, literally the entire event got canceled because of him. Dana hit the roof.
Yeah, no, Chael knew nothing about it. He wasn't in shape at all, and it would have been a lot easier for John Jones to fight him then than giving him a full training camp. You know, and I realized that Chael and I have different styles, but, you know, we're both wrestlers. I just kind of hit harder than Chael, and I think I was shocked that John Jones didn't take that fight.
How was working out with Chael? Was he a good partner to work out with in the room? And how was that?
Yeah, and he had worked out. He's one of our training partners, Randy and I, with in Greco before that. And so we had known him a while. And when we opened that Jim Performance Quest, Jim is our front desk girl at that gym. So he was probably, you know, our first Team Quest member besides us two. So,
wow.
Yeah. And then Matt Lindland came along about a year after. And then, you know, we changed locations. We kind of didn't want to be in the health club business anymore. So we just shut that thing down and then opened up an MMA gym.
Nice. You talked a minute ago about you felt like, you know, obviously you hit harder than Chael. Now, do you feel like that came from just practicing boxing? I mean, obviously a lot of natural power. I mean, when did you realize how devastating you of a right hand you had? Because, I mean, you know, it came with its own name and you lay a lot of people out. When did you realize you had that kind of power?
Yeah, I don't know. I think when I was first training MMA and working with boxing coaches or kickboxing coaches, and you know, they all said, oh, I hit the pads hard, but I'd never even sparred and went and fought, you know, and still went and fought in the UFC and never even sparred before.
Wow, that's crazy.
You know, obviously we went hard grappling, but not sparring hard, not hitting hard. So after that, we started sparring, and that's probably when I discovered, or everyone else discovered, that I hit hard. and then as I slowly got better technically and setting up different things is when I started landing it. So, you know, I knew I kind of hit hard, but, you know, I still didn't knock anybody out for a while.
Well, you also hit a chin of granite as well. Alan Goez was your – you were in a four-man tournament, UFC 17, May 15th, 1998. People need to really kind of understand where Alan was at this point. He had never lost in jiu-jitsu except one time in an absolute. He was like the 9-time national champion. He was Carlson Gracie's top student. And like you're talking about a guy that hadn't lost in like 6 years in any athletic competition, and he's heading up against you.
Yeah, and then he came out kicking me.
Yeah.
surprised me, and I didn't know how to check a kick back then. So, I, like I said, I'd never sparred, and yeah, and he had knocked me down, I think, once or twice. I just was so off balance at times just from not sparring and just, you know, doing that for the first time almost, you know, just getting out there. And but, you know, he did kick hard, and he knocked me silly one time, knocked me down, and then head kicked me, and they restarted us back on our feet because that was illegal back then even.
You had reversed it. Like, you literally took an illegal shin to the face, and like you, it just seemed, it didn't seem to have bothered you that much.
No, he had me knocked silly a little bit. So
you played it off.
Good poker face.
Yeah.
I call it autopilot.
There you go. Now, I mean, it is amazing. And I remember doing this too. I started fighting in 98, but, just, you were actually learning on the fight. You know what I mean? That was like your training camp was the fight. You would just fight to learn. And that's what it sounded like. You didn't train. You just, that was your sparring. That's unbelievable to find at that level. And that's where you're learning.
Yeah. I guess we were more focused on learning how to not get submitted as wrestlers, you know? So
yeah,
that was a big part of it. And then, you know, learning how to punch correctly and set things up and do more combos, and then figuring out how to check kicks, that kind of came after that. But, you know, I definitely know how to check kicks after Alan Goas kicked my leg a bunch of times.
But you were also durable. Like, if you look at that Goas fight, it goes to a decision. Carlos Newton, like, he tapped his guy out in under a minute. That's the guy on the other side of the ring, on the other side of the tournament. He's got to be celebrating with every minute that passes by in your fight, and he's fresh.
Yeah. No, he broke my jaw in that fight.
Yeah. Really?
Carlos Newton did. It was like a minute and a half or so left, I think. Towards the end of the fight, he hits me, and then I took him down. When I took him down, my jaw kind of shifted, and it felt weird, and I was like, ooh, that's not good. So it didn't really hurt at the time. Didn't knock me silly or anything. Just hit me right. And then, you know, later on, it hurt pretty good.
Did you have to wire it shut or anything? Or did you just...
No, I had it wired shut.
Oh,
I got home. Well, first thing, in Mobile, Alabama is where the fight was. I went to the hospital there, and they couldn't even figure out if it was broke or not. They couldn't work an x-ray machine very well. The doctor couldn't tell if it was broke.
Smoking.
Until after the doctor could tell, I guess, if it was broke or not. So finally, you know, I said, screw this, just give me some painkillers. I'll get it checked out when I get home. And then one x-ray, and they're like, oh yeah, it's broken, dislocated. So they wired it shut, and they had to do surgery on putting the dislocation back in there and put a little plate in there. And, you know, 2 days later when I went back, my muscles had pulled pulled it back out of socket again. You know, my muscles are so dense and tight that just pulled it back out of socket. So about 3 weeks later, I had to go get another surgery.
Put
it in the socket. And a day later, it was back out of socket again. So I said, fuck it, and just left it. So.
That's what I got other teeth. Yeah, I got other teeth. My
whole career with a, you know, jawbone a little bit out of socket. You wouldn't notice unless I opened my mouth and it got a little crooked. So
you got dropped twice in the first fight by Goas. Obviously got cracked again and kicked in the face by Goas, and then cracked again by Newton. Dude, you went the distance on both fights while it was pretty much Newton's first. Like, you, and to me, that's like, that was a heroic performance on your end.
Well, I appreciate that. Now, I mean, just being in such good shape wrestling, that's all it was. I mean, I couldn't have done that if I never wrestled before. Not just the control aspect of the fight, but just the endurance aspect and you know, being in good condition, just working hard all the years wrestling, just taught you how to get in shape.
And plus just the mental toughness of fighting through any tough situation. You just like, you just get up and deal with it, man.
So. Yeah, for sure. That's definitely a big part of how I was, just mentally was never, almost never a problem. You know, there's been a couple fights where I was flat or just mentally just not there. And it showed.
It was awesome though. Back in the day, you know, it was just, what is this guy? He's a wrestler. What's this guy? He's a jiu-jitsu guy. This guy's a kickboxer. There wasn't any, he does it all. There was just none of that. I mean, everybody had their specialty.
Right.
And they were okay at anything else, but you had a specialty. Now people are just good at everything. It's crazy.
Yeah, but they're not great at any one thing.
Exactly.
Most of the time.
Yeah.
Working out with Antonio McKee, how was your experience with him?
I don't think I worked out with him a whole lot. I know that he came a few times to our wrestling club, the Jets, with Bob Anderson. I think he wrestled with us a little bit, not a whole lot. I never did MMA or grappling with him. But you know, Heath Sims wrestled against him and then fought an MMA match against him, and it looked like it was the same match because it was, you know, Antonio doesn't like to throw punches.
Likes to wrestle.
He's an interesting guy.
Yeah, his son's kicking ass though, doing pretty well.
Yeah, his son's doing really well. Were you at his match when he went with, when he beat John Smith?
No, but I've heard about it, and Trail swears by it too. So, you know, I think it did happen. He was a good wrestler, really good wrestler. I remember because he was the same year as me in high school, and I remember going to the state meet one year. He was, I guess, ineligible all year until right before state. So he was like, whatever the qualifiers were to get to state, he was like 7-0 or 8-0 at the state meet, and then won state that year. So,
wow.
It was probably our greatest interview. Like, he was essentially talking about washing drug money in order to get shows to get the fights he needs, you know. Beat this guy's ass, beat that guy's ass. Mentioned you. That's my favorite.
No, I never worked out with him much. You know, I feel like we worked out in wrestling a couple times, but that was about it.
So the rings tournament that you had mentioned when we started with, it in terms of overall talent in one tournament, I you would be hard pressed to find a better tournament than that one.
Who was in it?
So you fought, I think, was it Bakori Gagit Dies? I just butchered that. Olympic, Olympian from
Ukraine or Georgian. I think he was either silver or bronze medalist in the Worlds. It might have been Greco. It might have been freestyle. I don't know, but he was, and that was at, I think, 100 kilos, 220.
That was Dan's first opening round fight.
He ended up being the biggest pussy I fought.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Surprised.
He tapped out from, I need him in the ribs, and he tapped out. He took a knee and tapped out.
He just may be there for a paycheck or something. I don't know.
But
Who else was in there, Mike?
I'll get to it real quick. So Hiromitsu Kanahara from Japan, that was your second bout. And then, like, that was it. And then you go to the UFC 23. Oh, no, UFC 23, you were supposed to fight Jason DeLucia, and it didn't happen. Was that because of the rings tournament?
I don't know about that. I wasn't supposed to fight in the UFC ever, other than when I did earlier, like in UFC 17.
Okay, because when I watched the Joe Slick fight, they mentioned your name as the original opponent for Jason DeLucia.
I didn't know anything about it.
Cool. The Rings Finals, Gilbert Ivel is your opening opponent.
Yep.
Fucking savage.
Yeah.
He's a big guy, man.
In the back of the head with one of the dirtiest elbows I've ever seen.
Yeah, I know. He didn't play very fair. But I went out and faked a double leg or something and threw a right hand and knocked him on his ass first time and then took him down. The problem is the rules were a little bit geared for the stand-up guys. There was no punching to the face on the ground.
Ugh.
Into the body, but they stand you up if there's no action within like 10 seconds. So I think I took him down like 15 or 16 times in a 10-minute fight.
So, Chris, it starts with Gilbert Ivel, his second opponent, Antonio Nogueira.
Easy to me. You're right. A little tough here.
Gets a split decision win over Nogueira, and he rolls into Babalu in the finals.
Man.
I think Maurice Smith might have been in that tournament. Henzo Gracie was in there.
Yep.
Wow.
There was quite a few big names in the tournament.
On the Russian side as well, there was like two or three gold medalists on the Russian side.
Valentin Overeem was in there. Yeah, and there was some good Russians in there too. I didn't know hardly any of them back then, you know, just getting new to the sport.
What was the check, the championship check?
You know, there was five fights. If I would have taken second place, I would have made about 30 grand. For five fights, the finals were worth 200 by themselves. So, 230 grand is what I walked away with.
Man, I mean, for back in then, that was, I mean, that's good now, but man, back then that was unheard of money. That's no wonder you, I mean, at this point, are you thinking, man, this is wrestling's not so good. This is not gonna be fun. I'm winning money.
Yeah, I mean, I was still wrestling, but, this was like, I think, just a couple months before the nationals, and then a couple months later would be the Olympic trials. So
okay.
I ended up not winning nationals and then being in a worse spot on the bracket for the trials. I ended up just having one bad match or a guy that I couldn't, you know, he scored on me and I couldn't score on him back because he just shut down and that was it. I think I won Pan Am's that year and qualified the U.S. to go to the Olympics, but at that weight class, and beat the current world champ. And
man.
And the guy that went in my place took literally last place, didn't score a point, and got, I think he got either checked or beat like 8-0 by the Cuban who was the current world champ. So it was kind of shitty to see that. I think the sun had cut on me.
Yeah,
sorry.
It's kind of bittersweet. I mean, you got the huge check, but yeah, you know your goal.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, looking back, I mean, I wouldn't have changed anything. You know, I still was in good shape and I don't think technically I could have done anything different in Greco, just, you know, maybe against that one opponent, I could have done something a little bit different, but I don't think not fighting MMA would have changed anything.
Is it like after this point, I mean, do you think you start taking MMA more serious or not really yet? I mean, obviously you had to at some point, but is it then or not till later or what do you think?
I think it was later that year. I went to the Olympics as a training partner and just to help those guys get ready and compete well. And then Randy went and fought in that rings tournament the next year. So from Australia, I went to Japan to corner him, and he ended up not doing so well. Just got caught in a guillotine by Valentin Overeem.
Yeah, dude, Valentino over him.
One of his only moves. You know, it was good, but yeah, he didn't do so well. But so then after that, I kind of really started thinking that I might be doing it a while.
So Valentin Overeem has got submission victories over Babalu and Couture.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I know that in the first King of Kings tournament, Babalu and Big Nog, I think they beat everybody else in the tournament by submission, except for me. But yeah, it was. I was a little bit nervous going in. That's why I was working so much on defending submissions. But I actually did spar quite a bit, and that's before that tournament is when I started sparring. So made a huge difference.
Chris, the shocking thing about that Rings tournament is. Wins a decision against Yvel, wins a decision against Noguera, or split decision, and wins a decision against Babalu. Like, your recovery time, like, in today's day and age, I'm going, that guy's on EPO. Like, there's no way he's fighting for 30 minutes and still, yeah. You know, being the alpha.
Like I said, it's just the way we were in shape. I was training to make the next Olympic team. I was in great shape, and some of the weight workouts I do are really, you know, high volume, a lot of reps, and really helps with your muscle endurance. So I had no problem doing that.
It's crazy. You know,
the worst part about that tournament was when I fought Noguera. We were in the clinch, and he jumps up and pulls guard on me. We're in over and under, and his ass just landed right on my leg and popped my MCL in the middle of that fight. You know, and it really, they didn't think I was going to be able to fight. And I between that fight and the finals, it was only about 25 minutes.
Oh.
And, you know, I was just the biggest bucket of shit back there. But, like I said, 200 grand will motivate you pretty well.
Hell yeah. But I mean, hold on. So both those fights went 30 minutes long?
No, they were 15. It was kind of like the ultimate fighter is two 5-minute rounds.
Okay.
And an overtime if needed.
And it's 3-minute overtime.
I went overtime against Noguera.
Man, that's still a long fight.
So I went 15 with him, 10 with Yvel, and then 10 with Babalu.
In Japan scoring at this time, like, the as smart as they are at this time judging, they were clueless. So you had two draws and one judge for Henderson. So clearly Dan won rather than the fight being a draw. And that was the culture back then.
Yeah, I think they just screwed up and said it, and then that was against, I think, Connor Hart. We should have won another round, basically.
And Babalu as well.
No, it wasn't. Against Babalu, I don't think there was any draws. I kind of had him. He didn't do much to me the whole fight. But I don't think that one was. I think I got all three judges on
that. You got all three? Okay. Chris, one of the greatest fights, like, if you guys want to turn somebody on to MMA history and just really understand the roots, Wanderlei Silva, Pride 12, December 23rd, 2000. There is no way this didn't take a few years off of your life.
That was a tough one. But I wasn't in the best shape for that, but because I had gotten, prior to that fight, I got strep throat. I was in a wrestling tournament in France and got an email. They offered me, I was supposed to fight Vitor, and he hurt his elbow or something, cut his elbow in training and then pulled out. So then they offered me Vanderlei. I had no idea who he was. I just said, okay, whatever. And, you know, when I showed up and saw him, I was like, damn, he looks a little scary, but, you know, whatever. I'll have to get out there and beat his ass. But yeah, he hit hard. He definitely hit me hard a few times. Then he illegally kneed me in the head. The rules were super goofy right then. I'm glad they changed them to just allow it all the time. But back then, if you were face down, you weren't allowed to be kicked or kneed in the head on the ground. I think because they said they would think that you couldn't see it coming. But if you're face up, it's fair game. Like for head stomps and shit. So that he had done it illegally and they stopped it. And then they said, oh, if you don't continue, the doctor says you're okay. If you don't continue, you're going to lose. it hadn't crossed my mind to quit anyway, but that was kind of screwed up.
Yeah.
Well, Dan, for everybody at home that hasn't seen this fight, it's two Tasmanian devils fighting. Like, it's just non-stop. Every exchange is just with bad intent, and it's over and over and over again on a 10-minute round. The referee, at one point, you guys both back up, take deep breaths, ready to go at it, and he throws up a yellow card.
Yeah, they didn't penalize us for the yellow card on that one. It was too good of a fight. But, I could – his eye in that fight was the worst eye I've ever seen in a fight. It was cut open, but it quit bleeding because it was so swollen that it – his eye, it looked like it, something from the Rocky movies, just, you know, where – it was completely swollen shut, the whole thing. Yeah. I mean, they would have definitely stopped that here, but.
It was Dan, right? Yeah. Well, he, in his several times, said that you were his toughest opponent and he would fight. And like he listed three other people that were obviously upper echelon guys. He said, I'll fight them way before I'll fight Henderson again.
Yeah, he was tough. I mean, I was like, you know, the second time I fought him, I was a lot. I mean, it was like 6 years later, I think. He had the belt, I think, for a few years. And, you know, I was definitely a lot more technical with my striking the second time than I was the first time. First time, it was just going out there and just trying to knock each other's head off, you know, so. It was a lot more cleaner looking the second time.
Chris, you had mentioned that some of the Brazilians, when you were there, they would little gamesmanship prior to the event. They would kind of mean mug you, kind of try to make you feel uncomfortable. Dan, did that take place with you as well?
You know, depending on who the opponent was, but most of the time, I think just mentally they gotta put their game face on to kind of get themselves ready to fight, you know, that mentally they're just not, they don't know how to compete very well. So they feel like they got to mean mug the guy that kind of like he's the enemy. And, you know, for me, I'd been competing in wrestling my whole life and knew how to get ready mentally. It wasn't anything personal. I'm just going to go out there and win, you know, regardless of who you are. And if I like you or not.
That's a great point he's making there. Cause I mean, we have a lot of people, they don't have that wrestling. It's almost like every time you go on a wrestling mat, that one-on-one, that's like a fight really. I mean, it's a competition. They don't have that. So they might've had 15 fights, but he had 1,000 wrestling matches. So they're probably still like an infant in many ways, but they understand the fight aspect, but they don't understand the mental preparation to get there. That makes a lot of sense.
Listen, I'm not trying to start a fight here, but jiu-jitsu matches are much different than wrestling tournaments.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a whole different attitude. I mean, and jiu-jitsu can really get slowed down. If you want it to slow down, you just hold on and just slow it down and can't do that in wrestling. And you have to be in a lot better condition and yeah, I think that was, it's just the whole
attitude.
Wrestling attitude is you got to be in a lot better shape to do it, and you got to be tough to do it, and that's kind of the way MMA is too.
And on weight, like jiu-jitsu, there's you're not cutting weight like wrestlers, man.
No, but I think most of those tournaments they weigh in the day of the match though too, so that changes things a lot.
It's still different than watching weigh-ins for jiu-jitsu tournament, watching weigh-ins for a wrestling tournament. It's not even the same game.
Yeah,
I don't think the rest of the world cuts weight like they do in America. Or I don't think, but
yeah. So
I cut my share of weight, but most of my fighting career, I didn't cut hardly any.
And I don't know. I remember I was talking to Matt Mitrione once, and he's in there in the steam room once because we had a guy losing weight, Jake O'Brien. And Matt said he's up against the window right here because he's so hot, and he's like trying to get a little bit of air. And he said that CB Dalloway is complaining, and you say, "What are you talking about? You're a wrestler." And he's like, "I got two sweatshirts on." And you start pulling off all these layers of sweatshirts and socks, and you weren't complaining at all. Matt always talks about it. He's like, "That dude was so tough. He just sat there and took that heat." Matt's against the wall trying to get a little bit of air against the glass. And he said, they were just sitting there taking it all. He said, "Man, I understood how different wrestlers are from everybody else once I saw that." So that was kind of funny to me.
Was that in New Orleans, I think?
I don't know. I wasn't there, but I just know Mitrione was there. And he said that he never cut weight in his life. And he said he was dying, had nothing on. And you were sitting there with like a plastic suit and like two sweatshirts and wool socks and all kinds of
stuff. Yeah, calling people pussies. Yeah.
It sounds like something I do.
Yeah, that's true. In Pride, there was a lot of shenanigans backstage in regards to fixed fights. You don't seem to have been involved in any. Was it ever offered to you?
No. That's why, I mean, it's just, I mean, I guess I wouldn't put it past some of them, but it's never been offered to me, and I've never, even some of the guys that I was closer to that fought over there, that, you know, I don't think it was off to them. I think, you know, some of the guys like that were a little bit older, that I don't know. I just think, I know that I've heard them say, "Can you please not take the guy down?" Not to me, but to other wrestlers that are fighting a stand-up guy. "Can you please at least wait till the second round and take him down," or something like that. And I think they said that to Tom Erickson once, and Tom said, "Oh yeah, no problem," and took him down immediately. We choked him and beat the shit out of him, and fight's over like in 20 seconds.
Oh, my bad.
Erickson was a huge dude. In regards to like Pride bribes, I highly suggest you guys watch the Mark Coleman Pride FC interview. He gets into Takata. Pretty interesting stuff. Henzo Gracie, my favorite Gracie out of the entire family, Pride 13. He's coming in with two losses in a row. Absolutely incredibly dangerous based on, I mean, he's got to get a win. What was your mindset walking into that fight?
You know, for that fight, I had guys trying to take me down the whole time while I was trying to punch him in the face coming in. And I figured as soon as we start, if I hit him, you know, standing up, I think he was going to try to take me down the whole time. And it's kind of what happened. He stood with me a little bit. I hit him, and then he started trying to take me down. But, you know, I was just not able to be taken down by somebody like him. I mean, not very easy, unless I was super sloppy with my punches or whatever, but I was aware that I was, you know, he was going to be trying to take me down the whole time. So I was just trying to hit him on the way in and missed him a couple times and then stopped the takedown and then hit him on the way in the one time and knocked him silly and then finished him. So that fight literally is one of the few fights that went exactly the way I thought. And trained to do it, you know, it just to a T. I figured that's how it would go.
High end Gracie was in his corner. What was he like at weigh-ins and post-fight?
He was fine to me, but after the fight, when I knocked Henzo out, I was expecting like some sort of another fight to happen or something like that. I was prepared for it, but he came out and just was completely fine and no problems whatsoever to me. And, you know, I think they were just trying to figure out what happened because nobody saw the punch that hit him. So, yeah, but it was a good one.
Ian was, I would describe him as somebody that I was probably pretty dangerous.
He didn't have the best attitude and you know, didn't care about doing shit he shouldn't do to people, I guess. It's probably why, you know, he ended up getting murdered or shot, I think, and killed.
He was a wild one. That was a wild guy, man, for sure. All right. We had Pedro Rizzo on, and Pedro cried when we talked to him about this next subject. UFC 31, Randy Couture, Pedro Rizzo, that third round.
That was their first fight, right?
Or their first fight.
They fought more than once, right?
They fought twice, and Randy dominates the first round. He has issues in the second round with cardio. Rizzo's really marching forward, and you know it looks like he's going for a finish in the third round. Big John stops it for a doctor to look at his nose. You beat the doctor in the ring, except you go under. Like the doctor's talking up top, you go under and you draw Randy down, and you're giving him like advice, breathe, breathe, breathe. You're buying time. You're taking time away from the doctor. So you're kind of giving them like a legit break. And then when they restart, Randy gets a takedown. He's got his cardio again and rides the round out.
That's great cornering right there is what that is.
I just know Randy couldn't walk right for a while. He took a lot of leg kicks, and Pedro kicks hard. That was definitely one that, you know, made you a little nervous as the corner, as a coach, saying, hey. Yeah, but, I mean, that's what – I mean, they do that all the time, stop it to look at shit, so.
Now, Dan, that was actually a fight, in my opinion, where – I mean, and I've had this happen, where Randy gassed out, you know what I mean? Have you ever can think of any fight where you just said, man, I mean – I've had it right in the third round or whatever. I'm like, I don't have anything left. I gotta just try and survive. Have you ever had that where you just like, I don't have anything left? Because it's only happened to me a couple of times, but it's horrible when it happens. And I think that's where Randy was in that fight.
Yeah, that first round, he had really shot his wad a little bit. And
yeah,
almost finished. Yeah, and you know, just kind of didn't quite get it done. And then, you know, you hit a little wall and says, oh, shit, you know.
Yeah.
I think that happened a little bit, not completely that bad, but a little bit against my first fight with Shogun. I tried to finish him in that third round, and this one is one of the first five-round main events, you know, when we started doing five rounds. So I was a little bit tired in that fourth and fifth round.
Well, did you, in my opinion, your kind of stall tactic, which is a phenomenal move from a corner, man, like that's what you're supposed to do. And them even allowing you in, it allowed Randy to kind of coast, win a controversial decision. Rizzo said he needed therapy for years because he never got his hand raised that fight and was actually in tears talking about it.
Oh, man. And Pedro's a good dude too, man. But yeah, I don't think I did it. I mean, I'm sure I did it intentionally, but it wasn't something that I think about. I just went in and tried to coach him and give him a breather. And
that's what you're supposed to do as his corner, man. You're supposed to give him every chance to win.
It wasn't something I thought about afterwards, you know, that saved the fight. I mean, he manned up and got in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, but But yeah, I mean, obviously, a little bit more recovery is always nice.
What about Hector Lombard as a training partner in the gym?
Well, every time I was there and sparred with him, that's whatever, no issues whatsoever. I never saw anything. Every time I leave town and come home, I'd hear about how he bullied this guy, bullied that guy, and tried to beat out that guy while they're warming up. And, you know, and I think Soka Ju had to put him in his place one time. And you know, so I was, every time I went with him, I was waiting for him to do something so I could, you know, just tell him, hey, that ain't fucking cool. And I'm gonna beat your ass for it. So it never happened. And we never had any issues. He just wasn't a good fit in the gym and decided to leave, or, you know, he wasn't asked to leave, but, you know, I don't think anybody asked him to stay.
Do you think maybe when you were there, you know, do you think he was almost like almost out of respect, or he just knew that this isn't the time to act up? And when you guys were away, I was like, okay, I can act up. Do you think it had anything to do with it? Or did, like, do you think he was affecting you guys or was like a scared to do anything when you guys were there?
I'm sure that it had something to do with both, you know, one, it was my gym, and two, that, you know, it probably wouldn't be a good idea if he did it, you know? So I don't know why in some people's minds they need to, you know, stroke their ego by beating up smaller guys during warm-up or, you know, when it's on light, you know, but from what I understand, I think he has that problem, you know, at other gyms. I know that when I was supposed to fight him, a lot of the, he was training at Top Team. Is that right?
I
would say half of the Top Team guys came up to me and told me to make sure I beat his ass. And they didn't like him in that gym either. You know, and I think 3 days before the fight, he had, we had a press conference and I had done an interview the week before, and they asked me, said, oh, Hector said, you know, that he didn't feel at home or comfortable at your gym and left. You never gave him your phone number. You never, you know, did this. I'm like, well, I never had an issue with him, but everybody in my gym thought he was a bully, you know, and that's kind of all I said. And during this press conference, you know, we're doing a face off with him taking pictures, and he's like, who told you a bully? And I'm like, what'd you say? Because you can't understand him very well. And he's like, who said I was a bully? And I'm like, oh, everybody at my gym. He's like, well, who? Literally everybody at my gym, like everybody. And I don't know. It just really pissed me off that he did it at that time, you know, right in front of the cameras. And I just said, you know what? I'm going to beat you up pretty bad. And I got him. Well, yeah, that's why he got an extra couple elbows on the ground after I had him out. I mean, after I knocked him a little bit silly, I just made sure that I finished him really hard. And he got a 6-month no.
Wow.
Contact.
Suspension?
Yeah, mandatory suspension, 6 months, no exceptions.
Wow, that's the longest I've ever heard of. So now on the same lines as you're talking about right now, making someone pay a little extra for their antics and talking, it reminds me of everybody's favorite UFC knockout of all time against Mr. Bisbee. I was just watching that, the Ultimate Fighter, and every time he was just sitting there running his mouth, you just kind of sat back and had this look on your face like, all right. I mean, was that kind of in your thought the whole time? Like, I can't wait to tear this guy up when I get the opportunity. Was that thinking for 6 months?
Basically, I was ready to beat him up. But honestly, I did the same thing to Vanderlei when I knocked him out, jumped on him and punched him one or two more times. I would have done the same. Honestly, I didn't take anything personally with Bisping. I just, the only one that I really wanted to really fuck up was Hector Lombard. that I ever fought. I mean, obviously I wanted to win and beat up everybody I fought, but you know, something that was a little more personal to me, and that was that one. But you know, the Bisping one, I mostly just said that for fun afterwards, but I would have done the same thing. I did do the same thing before that fight to Bander, almost, but it was a lot more fun to do it to Bisping.
Yeah, I can imagine after all that talk that was going on. I mean, that was just, like I said, at one point that was voted people's favorite knockout, because it was the him running his mouth the whole time you hit him, and then just that one more exclamation point at the end, the jumping on and really shutting him up was kind of nice.
Yeah. He doesn't like that fight, I'm sure.
Oh, no.
He's complained about, like, somebody made me a logo of me in the air for that fight, and I guess he's complained about it, you know, and I'm like, I don't know why he wouldn't like it. He's not even in the logo. I could make a little chalk line on the ground below it if you want.
The interesting about Hector Lombard is when he defected from Cuba in Australia, he went from gym to gym. When we did our interview, it was like, oh, you switched gyms again. The reason is because of exactly what took place at yours. Before his Kyle Noak fight, they broke into his house and they were going to shoot him, but he had dogs and they killed his dogs. Guns aren't even legal in Australia. That's how many people he pissed off in that country.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I think I don't know him that well. I just know that he was here for about 3 months, and like I said, nobody asked him to stay when he was leaving. So
after Akira Shoji, you mentioned Shogun Hua, your mindset going into that, is there any concerns, or are you real headstrong when looking at an opponent like Shogun?
I mean, I was pretty confident. I thought I would be able to just kind of mentally break him. You know, because I feel like in one or two of his fights, which I think he was coming off injuries or was injured, you know, where he just kind of didn't perform well and kind of just broke, it looked like. And my goal was to get on him pretty hard and then, you know, mentally break him and make him quit. And you know, he definitely proved me wrong on that one. He was as tough as they come in that fight, mentally and, you know, everything. So
he got split decision win. Did they ever offer you Sakuraba or Hoist? I mean, they were the obvious choices for you.
No, not Hoist. And I don't think they offered Sakuraba. Maybe they did one time, but I don't know what happened. I don't remember. But obviously it never happened. But for some reason there's just certain guys that you would think I would have fought but never did. And yeah, those two are definitely one of them, or two of them.
The Brazilians keyed on you as well. Like they sent every soldier they could at you. After Shogun, they send Ricardo Arona. After Rona, Nogueira wants another shot. Like, it's just, it was the all-star team.
Yeah, I never fought Shogun in Pride. I fought Rona in Pride. I fought Shogun in UFC.
Ooh, let me take a look. I thought it was Pride 14. You know what? Pride 17. I don't. Anyway, Arona. Well, you got Arona and Nogueira.
Yeah.
Two all stars.
Arona. Arona was a big and strong dude that was good at what he did, and you know, just kind of controlled me a little too much. He almost when I was trying to get up from being on bottom, he almost got a choke on me. Yeah, he was tough and strong, but just, I don't know, just one of those guys that's a little bit tougher to fight based on just kind of, he was pretty controlling when it got on top.
You know what? I stand corrected. You had Ninja Rua. I was talking Ninja Rua, not Shogun. I apologize. So you had Ninja, then you had Arona and Nogueira. I mean, those guys were really keen. And Nogueira is a big guy too. You're not even in the same weight class.
No, and I think they called me up like 10 days out for that one.
Yeah. Did travel bother you?
Does what?
Did travel, jet lag, did it bother you?
Not too bad. Going to Japan was a lot easier than coming home from Japan. By the time you get there, it's usually evening time. You check in and eat dinner and it's bedtime. You just wake up a little bit early the first day. So it's pretty easy to acclimate on the way there, but on the way home it was a little tougher. No, I didn't mind it at all. I was used to it from traveling all over wrestling.
Now, did you like, I mean, going over to Japan, especially in the Pride days, I mean, that was like the elite of the elite. You were treated, you know, very much like, I think, kings over there in Japan. It was a big deal, and more so than it was over here in America at the time when Pride was big. I mean, did you have a good time when you would go to Japan?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was like they were great to the fighters. They, you know, all the fans were always respectful and, you know, nobody hardly ever, I heard booing, you know, and at that time in the UFC, you'd hear booing every show when they were grappling, you know, or it was nowadays the fans kind of understand the sport a little better here, but back then, you know, the Japanese fans understood the sport really well, especially the grappling. You'd hear them all go ooh or ah when you know somebody would advance position or get a good position on somebody. They would understand all that. So that was always pleasant to see. And even though the crowd was more subdued and fairly quiet, there was a lot of energy there still. So. You know, it was still fun to fight there, absolutely. And the Pride shows were unbelievable. The production that they put on was crazy.
Yeah. It was always good. Like you said, the crowd was educated. They would be very quiet until something important happened. Like I said, even if it's a submission, if he moves the mount, then all of a sudden the crowd would go nuts and then they'd quiet again when it calmed down. So it was very good. You didn't hear any of this, stand him up, ref, or kick his ass. It was always educated. They understood what was going on, and they respected the sport, and they loved the fighters. Win, lose, or draw, if you came to fight, they loved you, and that's always good because I feel like in America, you could, even if you're coming to finish the fight, if you get out-jabbed or something, I mean, you're the loser, and they don't care. But over there, I just like the attitude they had.
No, absolutely. It wasn't about the win. It was about the, you know, how you competed.
Exactly. I love that. I wish we'd have more of that here. So,
Dan, did you party in Roppongi at all?
What's Roppongi?
Roppongi's a bar district down there where they'd always go out afterwards, go to Roppongi where all the bars were and everything.
Yeah, he knows what it is. I think he's.
I was messing with me. Okay, my bad.
I think his wife is listening, Chris. I think that's.
No, I did spend, you know, a few nights there. The kind of the problem was it wasn't like the most popular night. Pride would always have their shows on a Sunday, midday Sunday. Mm. So Sunday night wasn't the most, the biggest bar night, you know. So we still went out and had fun, but a lot of times it was a lot of the fighters in their camps at the bar with you, so, which was still fun. You know, we had a good time, but I definitely have been out to Roppongi, yes.
What about BJ Penn? Him training for Matt Hughes. The rumor was that there was legendary grappling sessions between yourself and him.
I don't think that we did too much of that. I don't think so. No. I mean, he is really good at certain things, but yeah, I think he was, I definitely grappled with him a couple times, but not, it wasn't like a huge amount.
Okay.
Was it, are you talking about the second time or the first time?
The second time.
Was that when DJ had the belt at the lower weight class?
Yes. Yep. Yeah.
I didn't train with him at all. I remember watching it on TV, obviously rooting for BJ to get a second belt. Cause at the time I had, with Pride, I had the two belts thing happening, and I was rooting for BJ to do it as well. And I was just so disappointed that he kind of showed up and wasn't in the best shape. And I think that's what, I think he's much more skilled than Matt Hughes was at the time. And, you know, BJ's biggest problem has always been his cardio.
Yeah.
And I was pretty disappointed that he kind of wasn't in the best shape for that, with that big of an opportunity.
What about Phil Baroni working out over at Team Quest with you guys?
He was, I don't know. He's one of those guys that's hit and miss, but yeah, we worked out a few times. I wasn't up there. It was when I was living in California and he would go up to the Oregon gym. He kind of tried to, fit in and do well. He was up there, I think, went there quite a few times, I believe. And I don't know. He's just one of those guys that makes it hard to like sometimes.
How did he do when he trained with you? I mean, was he talented, fairly talented? Did he work hard? I mean,
I think most of the time, I mean, he really needed work on obviously the wrestling, the grappling type stuff. And he wouldn't do very well with anybody with that. He would just be on the bottom most of the time. But, you know, I didn't, like I said, I didn't work out with him a whole lot. I don't really remember any sparring sessions. I don't know if I was there on any sparring days that he was there, just more of the grappling stuff. And he wasn't very good at that.
You guys used to torture him. Matt Lindland.
Oh, they did. Yeah. But
he got under his skin. Yeah,
which is surprising that he would go up and start training there after that. Matt really got under his skin quite a bit.
You released instructional videos under Century and their Straight Blast Gym, Jiu-Jitsu Killer. You introduced, you referred to it as the Henderson Headlock. And then the jiu-jitsu community goes, no, I mean, it was almost like kind of a slight, no, it's the five-finger headlock. Sorry, Dan, even though, you pretty much, brought it to, what everybody's knowledge.
Yeah, is that a question?
I don't know, dude. It's more of a statement. I apologize. Sorry, Dan. We got on here.
Yeah, no, like I said, there was no MMA coaches when I started fighting, when Randy started fighting. So it was one of those things of figuring out, what wrestling positions and what control works good. And then what submissions from wrestling moves you can do, or put yourself in a position to really finish somebody. That was an experiment, and that was kind of fun to figure out new moves. Randy and I had been wrestling Greco for a long time, and you're really limited on what you can do in Greco, especially, because you can't grab legs, you can't trip, it's all mostly upper body. So a lot of the practices get redundant and you're working on the same shit every day. And, once I started MMA, it was, so much more exciting to be able to learn new shit finally. And then figure out ways to choke somebody or do some sort of submission with it was pretty awesome.
Yeah. Did you just, the community renamed it the 10-finger guillotine? It's the Henderson headlock. That's what I'm staying with.
Remember that, yeah.
Yeah. So Murilo Bustamante, another Brazilian. They really, really, like, targeted you, in my opinion.
Well, I mean, there wasn't that many countries that had really good fighters at that level back then. You know, Brazil is definitely one of them that still has good fighters. And then, you know, obviously America. And so a funny story, you know, every time I'd go to fight a Brazilian in Pride, especially, they would, depending on who I was fighting, you know, like I said, there was like the shootbox guys, and then there was the Brazilian top team guys, you know. And every time I'd fight a shootbox guy, I'd get to Japan, and you know, I'd see one of the top team guys, and they'd tell me, you know, make sure you go kick his ass and blah blah blah. They hated each other so much that they would just root against him and root for me and tell me, you know, go beat his ass, go do this, go do that, or whatever. And then when I'd fight the top team guys, the shootbox guys would do the same thing. And it was just so odd to me that, you know, there's Americans over there fighting other people too. And you know, Americans root for Americans almost always. Yeah. So it was just so weird to have Brazilians come up to me and tell me to beat their countrymen up, and you know, just because they're in a different faction, you know. So yeah, it was pretty funny.
I always liked it whenever I felt like whenever I went to foreign country, yeah, the Americans would stick together. We'd be like, it's us against them, not I beat him. He's a different American, not on my team. We always stuck together. I felt like it was nice. Because the rest of the people weren't for you. So it was always good to have somebody who's not on that team. You know what I mean? If you're from America, I'm from America, we stick it together. I always felt like that's how it was.
Yeah, I just think it was kind of a big rivalry for so long down there that they couldn't get over it.
You knocked out Murilo Bustamante in 53 seconds. I know there was an accident. Was there an accidental headbutt in the exchange?
A minor one. He went, I was changing levels and he shot in at the same time. And then he, you know, kind of grabbed my leg and tried to take me down. I pushed him away and hit him in the face. That fight was a last minute fight for me too. I had knee surgery, ACL and meniscus surgery, like 7 weeks before that. And I was up in Colorado hunting with my buddy. And this is like, you know, a long time ago, but my cell phone didn't work up there. And so they tracked me down on my buddy's cell phone and said, hey, we need you to fight in 10 days, 2 weeks or whatever. And I'm like, dude, I just had surgery and I'm up hunting, drinking beer every night, you know? And they said, well, and I currently did not have a contract. I just finished my contract up. And so they're like, well, we don't know what'll happen with any future contracts if you don't take this fight.
Man.
That was fucked up. So I thought about it for a day and said, okay, you know, if they couldn't get anybody else, I said, okay. And then, you know, obviously I think I told them I want my show money and my win money, you know, for sure. I don't, you know, 'cause it's last minute. So I didn't know what kind of shape I was in. I was up in 10,000 foot elevation hiking all over Colorado, but you know, luckily I was at least doing that, but my leg was still like inch and a half smaller than the other leg. You know, it was still recovering. Luckily it was so skinny that it knocked him silly.
And plus it was only 53 seconds. You have to worry about
The
funny thing is I got home from hunting before the camp and I dislocated my thumb on throwing a wide looping left hook. Dislocated my the big knuckle of your thumb down by where the meet was. And
yeah.
So when I got to Japan, I said, hey, can I get it numbed up for the fight? You know, and I had to tape it also. But and they said, yeah, but we need to have the doctor check it out first. So they checked it out. So then the fight, literally in the 53 seconds when I was finishing them, I must have, with my other hand, must have jammed my thumb somehow. And my whole other thumb was huge and swollen. I couldn't unbutton my pants for a couple weeks.
Man.
Yeah, it's hard to wipe your ass with no thumbs.
Not bad, man. Right.
Yeah, turn that shower on. Right. We're wrapping up. Yuki Kondo. Ooh. Were you poisoned before that fight? That's December 31st, 2004.
I felt like I was. I don't know. It was. I think there was a 24-hour stomach flu going around in Japan right then, and the night before I woke up like 2 a.m. Just had to get up and puked all the rest of the night. And anything that I would drink or eat would come up right away. So I think when I got to the, arena, because they always get us over there really early. And when I got to the arena, they gave me, I think, 4 bags of fluid. And
wow.
And luckily, the doctor had small fingers because he shoved a pill up my ass. I had like a 102 fever, so they bringing my fever down. I couldn't swallow it. I mean, I could swallow it, but I would just puke it up. So,
wow.
Dan, yeah, just so you know, we've had several guests on talking about issues and conflicts, all involving Yuki Kondo, like on the pancreas side. And yeah. People had mentioned poisoning, like Jason DeLucia, our Jason DeLucia interview. He said, man, they poison people over there.
I don't know. I mean, I did order room service, so.
Yeah. Now, Dan, did you ever think about being that sick, pulling out of the fight, or was that never an option? Or maybe you're like me, I have a sickness, I can't not do a fight because I feel like a puss. I don't know. But, I mean, was that ever an option to be like, I'm not feeling good, I can't do it?
I don't think it ever crossed my mind.
Okay, I didn't think so.
Not yet, but I mean, I wasn't sure what they were going to say, but they're like, yeah, I mean, I know here they wouldn't let me fight probably, with the athletic commission wouldn't, but maybe, I don't know, but I wouldn't have been backstage getting IVs either, I guess.
Yeah.
But, I think, and I did get, I think, the first 30 seconds of that fight, I kind of was doing well, almost had him. I had a full mount and a choke that I was almost like a guillotine choke. I was trying to finish him and he got out of it. And I was like, oh, fuck, it's going to be a long time. At one point we're standing in the clinch and he kneed me in the stomach and I almost threw up right then. And I just had to take him down and just hump him for the rest of the fight. And they gave me at least one yellow card. So they tried to take, you know, every yellow card is 10% penalty. Oh. So they tried to take it. I said, no, I didn't have to go out there and fight.
Yeah.
I did anyway. And you're not taking any of my fucking money. And they said, okay. Yeah, I get it. You know, if I was being boring with no excuse like that, but
yeah,
I typically always try to finish the fights. And that time I just tried to get through the fight.
Yeah.
Cyril Diabate came out and started training with you guys in January 2008. It seemed like you guys had a pretty good relationship.
Yeah. No, he's great. Yeah. He, especially when I was going to fight John Jones, he was perfect training partner for that. Just real long. He was a lot better technically than John Jones was with his striking. But probably not as awkward or unorthodox as John Jones was, but Cyril was super. He's just a great coach and very technical on his feet.
Yeah. Speaking of coaching, and this is it out of me, Chris. Bellator 155, Alexis Dufrenzy, the sneaky zebra. You guys coached her, and she beat Marlos Conan by an armbar.
Oh. Yeah. That chick had a lot of talent, but just went down the wrong road with, I don't know what it is, with how she grew up or who was around her, but just a super bad drug problem.
Mm. Dude, anybody beating an ADCC two-time finalist in Marlos Conan and beats her by armbar? Marlos is arguably the first women's world champion. It's incredibly impressive. She also beat up Kim Couture. I don't know if that was set up by design or not.
No, I don't know if that was when Randy was still with her or not. I don't remember that.
Yeah, it's got retribution written all over it. But Chris, I'm done.
Hey, man, Dan, that was unbelievable. Man, whenever I'm talking to people, you're always you're in the golden age of MMA. Everybody know everybody there, and you're always one of the favorite people to watch. Just a hard-nosed, tough, old-school guy. So, man, I can't thank you enough for not only doing this, but all the years of pleasure you've given everybody. And, man, it's just cool to see you're doing well, and I'm happy for you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And the feeling is mutual. I was always a big fan watching you fight as well. So,
makes me happy now. Thank you.
I'm glad that you retired so early.
I know. I had to come out of retirement and did 3 bare knuckle fights because I like that one. But, I just had a lot going on. And I wish the bare knuckle had been around earlier. I'd be involved. If you ever want to come to a fight, let me know. We'd love to have you see you in ringside, my man. Just anytime you ever want to come to one, let me know.
All right. Sounds good, guys.
Dan, you were my childhood hero. Truly an honor. I mean, I told Chris I might fanboy. I hope I controlled it enough. I sincerely appreciate your time. Honestly, Dan, thank you so much for all the memories, man.
No worries. Appreciate you guys. Thank you.
Take care, buddy. Bye-bye. Well, another fantastic episode of Lights Out Podcast. Anthony Schurz, you kind of were manning the board in the back.
Yeah.
What'd you think of the interview?
I thought it was pretty awesome. For my first sit-in interview to be with Dan Henderson, it's pretty awesome. I mean, he's a titan in MMA. Probably he could be on the Mount Rushmore. So it was pretty awesome.
And we only got to Yuki Kondo, which is like maybe about 30% of his career. But like, it's just a murderer's row. And like, what's shocking to me is like, what was your mental mindset? Oh, I was real confident. Like, you were confident going in the Shogun Hua?
Well, if you're Dan Henderson, maybe there's a reason to be, right?
Oh, for sure. So, ladies and gentlemen at home, this guy right here is going to be sitting in every once in a while doing mastering the board, helping correct some of the records whenever there's a little flub. And, based on us being really like a fact-based type interview, we're here to correct information. And oftentimes, things get said that need correction, and every once in a while we need kind of a third party to man the computer, and Anthony's going to be helping out with us. But if you guys want to help us out, like, share, subscribe, obviously, but you can also leave a rating. If you leave a 5-star rating, no matter what you say, I will read, but it's got to have 5 stars. Great podcast. Questions are serious and gives you true insight on the early days of MMA. That's from Joey G 1381. Y'all keep history alive and get some great stories out of your guests through some good and sometimes tough questions. And also your thorough research, the Sherlock Holmes of combat sports. That's from DM 11. And guys, like, comments like that help us grow. The only way we're going to beat these algorithms and kind of push it on, but we'll never be mainstream. But in order to kind of get to the audience that is interested in this stuff is with comments on our YouTube and reviews like that on our podcast. Anthony, any surprises in regards to the interview?
Actually, so when he brought up the Carlos Newton, the thing where he broke his jaw, I actually remember that because I watched that fight maybe about a month ago, and I think it was Blatnick or Goldberg was talking about how Henderson had broke his jaw. So when he broke it up, when he was talking about it, I was like, oh my God, yeah, I remember that. So there was that. And then also the thing where he got sick against Yuki Kondo. I would say that was another one.
If we, let's just say we had some unlimited funds and easy access here, I would like to interview every single one of Yuki Kondo's opponents, because there's every single person we talk to that has him on the radar. There's always something there. There's always, well, this kind of happened. Well, that kind of happened. And, you know, enough coincidences take place. Sometimes it's, you know, kind of intentional.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think that people would have caught on and, you know, maybe stopped ordering room service after a while, right? But yeah. I guess not.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it was an awesome interview, and I know everyone who likes the podcast will appreciate it. So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, having Dan Henderson on there is a must.
Well, here we had Larry Landless on, and Larry's like, "Hey, do you ever think about having Dan Henderson on?" And I mean, honestly, dude, that's childhood hero.
Yeah,
for sure, 100%. A guy that, you know, I looked up to and admired, and you know, I laughed and said, yeah, Dan Henderson's not taking our phone call. 3 weeks later, he's in the camp.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was going to say, the biggest moment for me of all time is probably when he knocked out Fedor. Like, that was like, I mean, I watch it now and I'm still in shock. I'm still like, holy crap, he just knocked out Fedor Emelianenko.
Yeah, with his finishing move, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And like, he fell, you know, face forward. I mean, that was a legit knockout, you know. And it's also, you know, Henderson usually fights at middleweight and he's a 185er. I mean, you know, what was Fedor, probably 230? So yeah, I mean, Henderson's, he's the man.
Yeah. And I was at that event, and I mean, you refer to that as like a holy shit moment. And yeah, Stan Henderson. And you know, the guy that really helped set this up, Joe Daddy Stevenson, every once in a while, I keep in touch with some of the guys that were on the podcast. And Joe Daddy, man, he really, really came through for us. Guy Max, also, that books the Hendo Fight Nights that they do out of his gym. He stayed on top of it, connected us. Henderson, I think his biggest asset is that he surrounds himself with good people and kind of gets away from the people that, you know, he shouldn't be around. Like, yeah, I think one of the shocking things in the interview was his admittance of the lawsuit with Rico Ciparelli.
Yeah, I don't really, you know, I'm learning more and more about Rico. I don't really know much about him. I mean, I have a decent amount of knowledge on MMA, but, you know, you're the detective, so.
Yeah,
you know, so long to lead on that one.
Yeah, so in essence, Rico started Raw. He was like a purple belt under Renzo Gracie before he got thrown out of the academy. Later got his black belt through Pedro Sauer. Frank Trigg, Matt Inchenko, Couture, Henderson, Tom Erickson. That was Raw. And that's a murderer's row right there.
Yeah, and that's a team.
In essence, Rico taught the guys, like, you know, how to beat jiu-jitsu defense. And his brother managed the guys. And it kind of ended ugly for everybody. So
it's unfortunate. Yeah, I'll have to look more into him.
So I've sent Rico, you know, several messages in regards to coming on a podcast, emails. He's never responded. I think I would tiptoe around topics like this, you know, in order to kind of get the meat of the other things that he was involved in. But I think whatever took place, was pretty hard on everybody involved. I mean, you heard Dan was pretty unfiltered. So
yeah.
We may or may not get Rico.
It is what it is. You know, we'll just keep interviewing the guests that we can, you know, getting the good content out there, I guess.
100%. Well, that definitely qualifies. We need YouTube comments and we need ratings on Spotify. I think it's just a star rating on Spotify, but a review on iTunes would really help us out. Anthony, you're also handling Chartable. You're trying to get us listed on Chartable. Based on our numbers, we got to be in the top 20 MMA podcasts. Would you not agree?
I would definitely say as far as the numbers, but you know, the numbers don't tell the story. You know, it's a great quote for a lot of different things. And, you know, I've listened to a lot of different MMA podcasts from different people. And this is far and away, if you're an MMA enthusiast, you got to listen to the Lights Out podcast. It doesn't get better than this as far as information and guests. It's
hardcore. It's not for beginners.
You guys got everything. So yeah, I was also going to add, make sure to follow our Instagram, like, and comment on the posts, repost it on your story. You know, not too long ago, I made one for, I made a reel for Coleman that was pretty cool. So, we're going to be making some for the, guests that we're having on here, and, you know, make sure to check out the reels. Tell us what you guys think, stuff like that, and follow our Instagram and stuff too.
Absolutely. Anthony, you've been helping out a lot, dude. You see the numbers, we're definitely growing, a little stagnant right now, but usually we push through after a couple big guests. Yeah, by the time this airs, Alan Goez would have been on. Fantastic interview. And Henderson, obviously, is going to be a big get as well. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you're listening at this point, you owe me a share. Thank you so much. Ant, always a pleasure, buddy.
Thank you, Mike. We'll talk soon.
Take care.
Check out the full interview on iTunes, Spotify, and all major podcast platforms.